we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. There's a long and sometimes noble tradition of atheist critiques of Christianity, from philosophers Hobbes and Spinoza through to Bertrand Russell and Richard Dawkins. Equally, there's a long and sometimes noble tradition of defences of Christian faith. In 1941, at the height of World War II, C.S. Lewis, a relatively unknown Oxford academic, started giving 15-minute broadcast talks on BBC Radio.
Somebody put it to me by saying, I can believe in God, all right, but what I can't swallow is this idea of him listening to several hundred million human beings who are all addressing him at the same moment. And I find quite a lot of people feel that difficulty. Well, the first thing to note is...
These addresses, to many people's surprise, found a ready audience at a time of darkness and despair for Britain, and later were collected as the book Mere Christianity, which is a classic today. The question of whether Christianity is true and whether it's good hasn't lost its resonance in the 21st century, if the bestseller lists are anything to go by. A new book makes a specifically Australian contribution to this genre. It's by Greg Sheridan, longtime foreign editor at the Australian newspaper, and it's called God is Good for You, A Defence of Christianity in Troubled Times. Sheridan believes that the West is in the process of banishing God from our lives, but he argues that if we succeed, we'll be left with an aching nostalgia for the divine. Speaking to him about his new book, I wanted to ask him straight up, is this just a case of an older white male wishing things were as they used to be?
Well, that's a very fair question. A lot of part of the book is an interview-based thing, and there are lots of folks who are not older white males in the interviews. And, of course, some of the most encouraging things in the book, Signs of New Life, involve young people, Chinese origin people, lots of women. There's a movement I describe, Focolare Fireside, which is under its constitution always to be led by a woman.
So you think it's not just this sort of plea for Judeo-Christian values of a bygone era?
I don't think so. I'm not arguing for the past. The past was a foreign country full of its own villains and full of its own terrors. I'm trying to hold up a mirror to where we are today. And, of course, one footnote is that the majority of Christians in Australia today are women. Women practice Christianity at a much higher rate than blokes do, because I think they've got more sense.
Yeah, I heard it described as, the church described as women's clubs with men CEOs, by one of our guests. Now, you indicate in your book that there's a sense of Christianity dying out in the West. What are the signs of that? The evidence kind of points in that direction, doesn't it?
It does. So it's a very eccentric place that the West is going, because the vast... all the rest of humanity has, in a sense, never been more religious. You know, Christianity is on fire in China. You can't think of a place like Indonesia or Thailand without thinking of its religious identity. I spend a lot of my time in Asia as the foreign editor. But in North America, Australia, New Zealand and Western Europe, the trends are unmistakable. Britain is already a majority atheist society. The last census showed Australia about 50% Christian, but a huge rise in disbelief, and the same trends are evident in the United States, although it starts from a higher base of religious belief. And the demographics are that the older people identify as religious, younger people much less so. It's not going to die out, but it's going to become a much more minority faith than it has been for the last 1,500 years.
And what's your sense of the main... factors? I mean, it's complex, but what are for you the main reasons for this decline?
It is very complex, so I want to give you an answer that doesn't take us 12 hours.
Yeah, please.
But so there are these broad historical causes, and then there's everything that's happened in the last century, the two world wars, also technology. the digital space is very unsympathetic to Christianity, but also affluence. You know, the Christian belief is that every human being needs the mercy of God. We all stand on the brink of our own nuclear annihilation at any moment. And every human being, therefore, is born into tragedy and needs God's mercy. But if you're very affluent and very healthy and life is good, you sometimes can convince yourself you don't need God's mercy. So there's a sort of a delusion. Then a final of many factors to mention, a final one is the culture has turned against Christianity to the extent that I think we're moving from being a post-Christian society to being a pre-Christian society. There's a lovely line of Philip Larkin's, "What remains when disbelief is gone," by which he means that for a long time you still use the moral categories of Christianity, you still have the ethical framework and all of its assumptions, even if you no longer believe in God or anything. But then finally you get to a point where that is just so distant that you don't encounter it at all. And I think kids who go through school today and secular universities and so on, they're better described as pre-Christian than post-Christian.
Mm. Now, you say in your book that once we've lost God, we'll become bored with ourselves. Do you think there are some signs of that already?
Oh, I think there are. I think liberalism, which is a sort of an outgrowth of Christianity, is going crazy because it is cut off from its roots and it's ripped out of its traditions. So it has no common sense. It has no sense of its own limitations. And in the end, if the liberal idea is just that everybody does their own thing, every human being fulfills their own dream, at one level that sounds appealing. Mm. But more often than not, human beings produce nightmares, not dreams. And if your dream is that you'd like to have sex with six-year-olds or that you'd like to kill 500 people, well, if there's no God, no absolute, no inheritance of Christianity, why is your dream any less good than anyone else's? And the only thing that mediates those nightmares then is power. And I think there is a neurotic edge to public life in the West today, which arises in part from an absolute confusion about purpose.
Lots of people would object to that kind of diagnosis, I guess, and they'd say, look, we've progressed to a point where we agree upon these sort of humanistic values, that we call them, which emerged evidently out of the Enlightenment, nowhere else, which we might have argument with. But nonetheless, we kind of agree to these sort of standards of living. Why do we need God for that to continue? Now, you'd have some issues with that.
Yeah, again, a complex question. Of course, I don't think our human values emerged out of the Enlightenment. I think they emerged out of Christianity. And so there's a chapter in the book which argues against the sort of Disneyland version of history, which is it was all terrible religious superstition until we got the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the Enlightenment thinkers were Christians, and they used Christian moral categories, which had been developed over 1,500 years of deep thought by Christians about ethics and conscience and the good life and human rights. I mean, the very Christian idea that every human being has an immortal soul and an immortal destiny, that is, in a sense, the basis of human dignity. The very idea that a slave, a woman, a foreigner had an immortal soul was what prevented the ancient world from treating slaves, women and foreigners in the way they always had. But to try to answer it more directly, I do believe human beings can live morally and, you know, as atheists or whatever. I certainly know lots of atheists who do that. I don't think a society can. And you can see the symptoms of it. There's an atheist philosopher, very fine person, Peter Singer, whom I quote in the book. I've no criticism of him as a human being. I've met him and dealt with him. He strikes me as a very good, conscientious person. But he argues, for example, he's a utilitarian. So he says if profoundly handicapped children are born, their parents don't want them, it's best that they're just done away with, best that they're killed. And I talked to him about this on television once. And he said, but surely you don't think merely the fact that they're part of our species means that they should be preserved. And of course, yes, I really do think that. I think every human being has inalienable human rights. But the Singer position, that's where the logic of atheism takes you. And
there is a consistency to that, isn't there? Like he is being consistent with the foundation of of his belief system.
Indeed, and I think he's a very useful philosopher. I don't mean that in any in any critical way. I think because he's honest and he takes positions to their logical their logical conclusion. And of course, if once you decide that handicapped babies should be done away with, well, maybe old folks should be done away with. Maybe handicapped adults should be done away with. Why should all human beings be regarded as having equal dignity? You see, I think if human beings are just a chancy outcrop of the biosphere, are they really entitled to any more consideration than a cockroach? And as I say, you can live on the moral capital of the Christian inheritance for a long time, but eventually that becomes so attenuated and then you're just left in a morass of confusion. And I think society tends to go a bit crazy in that circumstance.
I can sense the frustration you feel when you walk into a bookstore these days and you go to the religion section and there's nothing really substantial there. It wasn't always the case, was it?
No. The popular culture of the West has changed astoundingly in 50 years. I mean, if you or 60 years, say. The middle of the last century, the best-selling books and movies virtually all had a Christian theme. A little earlier than that, How Green Was My Valley, with the great clergyman Walter Pidgeon playing Mr. Griffith. There were books and movies like The Cardinal, Henry Morton Robinson, Graham Greene, Evelyn Waugh's novels were the height of English literature, and they were grappling with moral questions within Christianity and so forth. Even popular entertainment, our own author Morris West, you know, selling millions and millions of copies of The Devil's Advocate and The Shoes of the Fisherman and so on. Thomas Merton, the Cistercian monk, took a vow of silence and never stopped prattling ever after, but his first memoir sold several million copies. But 3 years ago I wrote a book, and I went to a lot of book festivals. I was very, thrilled to be invited to them. And amongst all hundreds of books that I saw, there was not a single book which was pro-Christian or pro-Jewish or explaining anything about Christianity or Judaism. Mm. So you typically go into a bookstore today, and God bless them, they're so kind, they've had my book there. But typically the spirituality section will have a shelf of, Buddhism, why is it good? Nothing wrong with Buddhism. I admire Buddhism, but it's generally the sort of the self-help dimension of Buddhism. Then it'll have a shelf of yoga and thin thighs in 30 days and be your best person or something. Then there'll be three or four books attacking Christianity.
Yes.
There'll be Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, and there'll be Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great. Mm. But there'll be nothing there at all for someone who might be interested, what is Christianity about? Now, of course, there are fabulous Christian books, but the secular culture never invites them in.
No, that's right. Those books are there. They just don't seem to be connecting with mainstream bookstores, and that tells you something, doesn't it, about the culture?
Yeah, well, I think the culture is kind of whiting Christianity out. I mean, take another measure apart from bookstores. I spent many years arguing the Australian television industry that there were too few Asians on Australian TV. You know, we were 10% of our population is Asian or something, and one character in 100 or one character in 1,000 really on TV was Asian. It's a lot better now. It's changed quite a lot. But the census tells us that there are still 50% odd of the Australian population self-identifies as Christian, and 15% self-identify enough to go to church regularly. Yet amidst all the sitcoms and dramas and so forth that you see, do you ever see a Christian? And are they ever sympathetically portrayed? I mean, 99% of the time the clerics are either child abusers or murder suspects or something. Yeah. And if there is some grumpy old Christian presented, it's as a force of reaction, trying to prevent their daughters marrying the working class boy or something.
Yeah.
But the idea that you just get a sympathetic character who also happened to be a Christian. You used to get that, even the beginning of the Inspector Morse series, you would get that. At the end of the Inspector Morse series, all the Christians had gone bad. So you could see the culture change in the twinkling of an eye, really.
Well, some people might go, bad luck. You've had 1,500 years of holding the keys, and now you've got to deal with being kind of marginalised, and you should just get used to that.
Well, I'd say two things about that, really. The first is the popular culture should reflect the society, and so it's not reflecting the society if it doesn't reflect Christians. And, of course, it's wiping out this magnificent inheritance. But towards the end of the book, when I'm suggesting future strategies for Christians, I say that we should think of ourselves self-consciously as a bold minority with something to say to the broader culture and a friendly minority. You know, we need to be involved in lots of controversies, but we need to be happy warriors, as cunning as our enemies, but much kinder. But nonetheless, we ought to adopt the posture, the tactics, the outlook of a minority. And when you're a minority, you expect that you'll be attacked, so that's okay, instead of thinking that we're upholding a social standard that everybody will, you know, abide by. And secondly, you can demand minority rights. And if Christians are demanding minority rights, it's not a special consideration for them. It's minority rights for the truth. You're saying, well, all right, let everything else be out there. You know, you should kill handicapped babies and all the rest of it. All these ideas can be there, but there's got to be a place there as well for the Christian idea, for the Christian alternative.
Not unrelated to this is your sense of, well, not despair, but your concern with education in the West, where typically if you're studying history or philosophy or English literature, you'll be told pretty much that the West is the demon of all cultures, and by extension, Christianity is too. Why is that happening, and why is that such a problem?
Well, I think that is happening, and it is very problematic. So Christianity is, of course, a universal religion, and the majority of Christians today, I guess, are not from the West. In fact, I'm sure of that. The majority of Christians would not be from the West today. Nonetheless, Western civilization emerged out of Christianity, and you can't understand Western civilization if you don't understand Christianity. Henry Kissinger once remarked that this digital age is giving us access to more information than we've ever had, but less actual historical knowledge, less ability to integrate the information in any meaningful way into a narrative about ourselves, our society, and our past. I think it is vandalism to deprive kids at school from the substance and the fun of the Bible. So there's a chapter in this book about the Old Testament. I hadn't read the Old Testament that closely in my life, as that's a great failing on my part. But what fun the Old Testament is. I mean, why would you stop kids from ever having the fun of reading the book of Jonah or the joy of reading the book of Ruth? And given how central these have been to the development of Western civilization, you've got this huge problem of cultural literacy if you deprive kids of it. But also, it's just such good material. Even if you're not a religious believer, you know, Abraham Lincoln, all he had to read was Shakespeare and the King James Bible, and he you know, became a great leader and a great writer of English prose. I think that's got to be as worth learning about as, you know, Kim Kardashian's diet or you know, the latest postmodern critique of Western civilization had a lot of things wrong with it, of course, like every civilization does. And, of course, the great books of Christian history are full of critiques of the bad things. I mean, Dante's The Divine Comedy has Pope Boniface in the eighth circle of hell or something, you know, for his misdeeds. So if you study the great books, you get plenty of critical insight. It's not as if you just get a celebration of the West.
So you're sort of urging people, if for no other reason, to read the Bible because it's a great story.
Oh, absolutely, especially the Old Testament. I mean, I may get into trouble here with fellow Christians, but, you know, obviously the New Testament is the centre of Christianity, but there is a sense in which the Old Testament is kind of more fun, you know.
A bit more humour, I think you say, don't
you? Yeah. I mean, parts of the Old Testament are great poetry and parts of it are written in a very elevated style, as you might find in the, I don't know, the op-ed page of The Australian or something, but a lot of it is written in the style of the Daily Telegraph or the Herald Sun. It's very punchy. It's very direct. It's got great sub-editors. It gets the names right. There is tremendous humour in it. You know, The Book of Jonah is like a Mel Brooks comedy. It's screamingly funny. It has a deep, serious message at the end. You know, Jonah has to preach to the horrible people of Nineveh, and they repent and avoid destruction. And he's disgusted by it. The last thing he wanted was for the Ninevites to avoid the fate which he felt they so richly deserved, and he goes off into a terrific sulk and so on. So the deep message of the Book of Jonah is that the God of the Old Testament is a universal God. He's the God of the Ninevites as much as the God of the Israelites, and his love is available to the Ninevites as much as to the Israelites. But in the meantime, you get there through this rollicking story of Jonah trying to get out of having to talk to them, racing off on a bit of a cruise and finding himself in the belly of a whale or a beast of the ocean and so forth. And then, of course, Jonah unreconciled at the end, going into a terrific sulk.
He's a big sook, isn't he?
Yeah, I can really identify with Jonah. You know, his absolute determination not to be happy, you know.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Greg Sheridan's new book, God is Good for You, could have been a pessimistic, grumpy book, but it's really not. It's a generous, wide-ranging treatment of an important topic. One of the reasons he sat down to write it was because he thought that we in the West are in danger of throwing Christianity out the window without really knowing what it is we're rejecting and what we might be missing out on. So I wanted to clarify with him his take on what the Christian message is all about and why there's still something revolutionary about it.
Well, one of the joys, Simon, of writing this book was to refresh in my own mind just how radical and extraordinary the claims of Christianity are. First, the supernatural claims. God is a triune God who sent his Son out of solidarity with humanity to suffer humanity's woes, and then that every human being has this immortal destiny and is specially created by God in the likeness of God. These are radical claims, and they were incredibly radical when they were brought about. I mean, there's a sociologist of religion whom I quote who argues that the reason Christianity spread so rapidly early on was because it was the best deal for women that the ancient world had ever known. The idea of marriage embodying reciprocal love, the idea that there was a power outside the head of the family who would arbitrate morality, in other words, God, you know, meant that that Christians had, and also then the fact that they didn't kill their female babies, meant that they had a lot more daughters, and the daughters, you know, in due course converted their husbands and so forth. But, yeah, both the theological claims and the social consequences of Christianity are indeed quite radical and a new challenge to every generation, I think.
Another thing that you don't shrink from, personally or in the book, are the supernatural claims of Christianity. Why do you think people do tend to be sort of embarrassed about those these days?
Well, modern society is very confused about this, very confused. On the one hand, they'll honour some traditions that are very supernatural. But on the other hand, there's a sort of a folksy realism which says, surely this can't be true. So even people who regard themselves as sympathetic to Christianity say, well, you know, Jesus was a nice bloke and, you know, he lived well and so forth. But look, let's not be silly about miracles or the ascension
virgin
or anything.
Virgin resurrections.
Yeah, the ascension into heaven, the resurrection particularly. Whereas, of course, if God can only do the things that people can do, then there is no God. The Gospels don't really allow you to interpret Jesus that way. At every moment, he is healing the sick, performing miracles, talking about judgment. On the cross, as he's dying, he says to the good thief, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Now, either he's lying or there is paradise. You know, there is a supernatural life, and there is a life after death and so on. The claims, actually reading the Gospels again and reading the Old and the New Testament again, as I did for this book, it's quite startling how stark and strong it is. And it's not exactly the comfortable sort of, as you say, domesticated kind of belief. Well, don't take all of that miracle stuff too seriously. Just, you know, be a nice person, and that's all there is to Christianity.
Now, Greg, in this book, you're urging people not to reject Christianity out of hand without actually knowing what it's saying. What is it saying?
Well, what it's saying is the center of Christianity, in my view, is the person of Jesus Christ. And what he's saying is that Jesus Christ is God. He's come to save humanity. He loves each individual, and he's conquered death. And if you walk with him, you'll walk into eternal life. And these are sort of giant radical claims, and as perfectly reasonable for people to reject them, but I think it is worth having a look at them. And it's worth, in the second half of the book, which is reported about individuals, it's worth having a look at how these beliefs play out.
Yes, because I think lots of people today might have as a vaguest understanding of that. But in their minds, it might be thought that the last place you get the full life is in Christianity, whereas you'd be arguing for something much more different than that.
Absolutely. So I believe that the importance of Christianity, or the importance of God, is that he's true. But incidentally, let me just offer this footnote. It's astonishing that sociologists right across the spectrum, whether they are themselves, profoundly committed atheists, or that very tiny number of them who are religious, report that the happiest people in the world are people who have religious belief and attend a church or a synagogue or a temple once a week or more than once a week. Mm-hmm. And I quote a lot of sociologists in this book. Charles Murray is very funny. He says this is very, very perplexing, unsatisfactory result for sociologists. They don't like it at all. Mm-hmm. But and of course, the new atheists have a problem of saying religion is terribly bad for people, and then they have to say, however, it's a pro-survival evolutionary adaptation because it confers benefits on people. But that's a long-winded footnote. Those are secondary matters. I think the only importance of God is that he's true, and if he wasn't true, all the secondary matters don't matter whatsoever.
Yeah.
And the greatest evidence for his truth is the human experience of him. Again, this is a form of evidence which the new atheists don't like very much, but I quote Roger Scruton in The Soul of the World, I think is the book, and he says, really, this consistent testimony of human beings over thousands and thousands of years of their relationship with God, that is the most significant evidence that human beings have about God.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that because you make a big deal of this. Personal experience says something about the veracity of the claims and so on. How would you describe your own personal experience of God?
Well, of course, that's something I avoided.
You did in the book, but we can't let you get away with it here.
Well, again, though, let me enter this footnote. I'm a secular journalist. I'm the foreign editor of The Australian. My life is involved in the rough and tumble of politics and journalism and all the rest of it. So it was quite a big thing for me to get to the point of writing about God. So I respected the old secular inheritance that people of my generation didn't talk too much about religion so that we wouldn't argue about it. Then the other hurdle was you're not really worthy of writing about it. But then you think, well, you've got a public microphone, and if you leave it only to the people who are worthy of it, it'll be a very small, very small cohort. And then also you deprive people of the solidarity. If believers are too shy to talk about their belief, they deprive other believers of the solidarity of knowing that there are people around them. So that was a long-winded way of not answering your question. But, I mean, I grew up in a, traditionally religious family, and I've never had any trouble believing in God at all. I've had enormous trouble living up to the practice of Christianity. Vast, vast trouble there. I've led the normal rackety life of a journalist, But God has always seemed to me kind of self-evident, and I talk to him a lot, and, I rejoice in the mercies that he sends me in my life.
Greg, you dedicate a whole section in your book to the sexual abuse scandals that have really racked the church in not just in Australia but other parts of the world. This has been maybe the greatest blasphemy of our lifetime, hasn't it?
I think it has. It's the worst thing I've ever heard about my own church, the Catholic Church, in my lifetime. And it's absolutely unspeakable. And, it's right that it be aired publicly. It's right that the priority be on the victims. And it's right that the churches have to undertake some deep penance over this. It's difficult to keep it in proportion. One of the politicians I interview is Bill Shorten, and his parish priest as a kid turned out to be a shocking criminal pedophile. And, I admire Bill and all the politicians I interview in the book. And I said to him, well, did this ever drive you towards atheism? And he said, no, I accept that very often the messengers have been pretty crook. Sure. But the message... love your fellow as you love yourself, love God and love other human beings, is not compromised by the compromises of the messengers. The other thing I'd say about it is that I do think it's very important for Christians to face up to the crook things in their inheritance. But in my view, historically, overwhelmingly, Christianity has been a force for good, and today Christianity is a force for good. You know, the greatest deliverers of social service after the government are the Christian churches, predominantly operating out of a sense of solidarity, that the love of God impels them to love their fellow human beings. And while these abuse scandals are utterly shocking, and it's right that we're thrashing through them publicly, it's not right that they should mean that a consequence of them is that the Christian churches should disappear from the public square. Sadly, many institutions have had their troubles, but I don't think all of those institutions need to go into liquidation or no longer have anything decent to say to the society more broadly. But I do think we've got to look it square in the face and be unflinching in our honesty about it.
In regard to that terrible chapter, though, what do you think might be required or for the church to regain its lost reputation in this regard?
Well, I don't have any easy formula or answer to that question. I think there is no single answer. The truth is the Christian church broadly, just has to do what it does. I mean, it has to proclaim the truth, act with love, be kind to people, try to help a distressed society. As Francis puts it, be a field hospital in a time of war.
Yeah, it's not a bad image, is it?
Yeah. I mean, it just has to do all the things it's meant to do. It's not... it needs to find new communications techniques and all that sort of thing, but the essence of what it needs to do is no different now from what it was 100 years ago. It's certainly no different now from before these scandals. And... if it's true to its own truth, that's the best formula for it to proceed, I think.
And finally, what are you hoping for the book? I know I'm sure the Christians will love it, but presumably you're hoping this gets a wider audience than that.
Well, the fact that anyone would like it is a joy beyond measure. So people have said to me sometimes, who did you write it for? What demographic are you aimed at? But I really don't have that in mind. I want it to be a general discussion, if there's any possibility of that. I hope that Christians who read it might find some reinforcement for their beliefs in it. I hope Christians or non-Christians who read it might say, well, gee, that Sheridan is an idiot, but Tertullian, whom he quotes from the 3rd century, he's interesting. I want to go and get
a second look at that.
Yeah, get a bit more of him. So I want to put people in touch with things that they find nourishing. I want to challenge what I think is an anti-Christian orthodoxy. So I would hope that, broad-minded non-believers or even closed-minded non-believers. I found it valuable to read all the new atheists. I found I disagreed with them utterly, but it was nonetheless interesting to get their point of view. Well, certainly it would be novel for an atheist to have a read of this. So I think one of the things we're losing a little bit in the digital age is the sense of a common discussion. Yeah. And insofar as it can make any contribution to that, to you know, to the very mission that the Center for Public Christianity is about, trying to get Christianity in the public square, yeah, that would be, I'd be very happy if that was a consequence.
From the Center for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith. I've been speaking with Greg Sheridan about his new book, God is Good for You, A Defense of Christianity in Troubled Times. This is an interesting, provocative, and engaging book, and it's for everyone, believer or not. If you like this conversation, do consider subscribing to our podcast so you don't miss out on more episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we'd love you to leave a rating or review. Let us know what you think of the show and recommend it to other people. Next week...
To be a Tamil Christian in itself is a minority, but then you take that and transplant that as a refugee community into a country like Australia. The Tamil Christian community in Australia is kind of even more proportionally smaller again.
Yeah.
We're obviously, we're very active and we're very loud and we have churches and we're kind of everywhere now, but it is a minority of minorities. And then to go into politics, to go into professional politics from that group is then again in a very, very small minority. Again, from an Eastern culture coming to Australia. I hope this changes over time, but Australia is just not at that place where immigrants and refugees from the East have been completely integrated into public life in the way that I think and I hope will happen over time.